Greg Masters reporting for Health Innovation TV from the 4th National ACO Summit in Washington, D.C. And I have the privilege of speaking with Shannon Brownlee, who is Senior Vice President at the Lown Institute in Boston. And she just finished moderating a panel on patient engagement in healthcare decision making. So, Shannon, let's talk a little bit about you and what you're doing at the Lown Institute.
Well, the Lown Institute is an old institution that has been repurposed. And what we're focusing on right now is the enormous problem of overuse in healthcare. And we're looking specifically at shifting medical culture, both among clinicians and in the general public, around this idea that more is always better when it comes to healthcare.
So why are you focused there? Is it a problem?
It's a huge problem. The estimates are that anything from 30% is sort of a general estimate for how much of the care that's delivered is really unnecessary. And if we included how much of the care is unwanted, if patients really understood what the trade-offs are, it would be higher.
So of a $2.7 trillion spend, do you have any sense of what that might look like?
If the estimates are correct, we're talking $800 billion of waste going towards care that patients don't need. And that money could be better spent helping patients get the care they do need, because while we're over-treating patients, we're also under-treating at the same time. But also, the other piece of this is not just about money, it's about harm. Overuse causes enormous harm to patients. Just because the treatment isn't needed doesn't mean it suddenly the risk of harm goes away. It's still there.
And we're at an ACO summit, and you chaired this panel on patient engagement. Is there a connection?
There's a huge connection. So the sort of standard way of thinking about patient engagement and shared decision making is around elective procedures. So think about getting bypass surgery, for example, for stable coronary angina, chest pain. This is a decision that the patient and the clinician should be making together, and whether or not the patient wants the procedure should depend in part on whether they're an appropriate patient, but also on whether or not getting that procedure and the risks that come with getting it are really what are best for that patient. And we know from a huge volume of literature that patients are, A, very poorly informed about what their what the potential risks are as well as the potential benefits. But B, what they care about doesn't get put into the equation. And this is crucially important around medical decisions.
And why is that the case?
We also have a lot of data suggesting that there are multiple reasons why what patients really want doesn't get into the decision. Part of it is that clinicians are not trained. We don't set out to train young doctors and young nurses to elicit what it is patients really want. Number two, clinicians are in a hurry, and talking to patients takes time. Depending on the patient's level of prior engagement and their education, it may be very difficult to convey complex information to patients. The other piece of it is that we have had a culture for a long time where patients think doctor knows best. So getting to a place where we're really helping doctors and patients and nurses and patients really talk to each other is going to take time, it's going to take retraining, it's going to take different incentives, it's going to take measurement. It's a radical shift.
I was just thinking while you were describing that in the session today, there was I hope it was properly attributed to you, but it was something like, I am not my diseases. I am not my diseases.
And I don't want to be managed. That was me. The term disease management implies that the disease is this entity other than the patient. And I am not my diseases. I'm a person, and I have desires and goals having to do with my family and my career and the way I live my life and my feelings of comfort. And my diseases are just part of who I am. And so I don't want to be managed. I don't want my diseases to be managed. I want to be able to partner with my clinicians.
So is it the model or is it the man or woman that stands in the way there?
the model of medicine is part of it, and then the individual clinician is part of it as well. There are going to be clinicians who are never going to be willing to really engage patients. And then there are clinicians who are ready to do it now, and there are clinicians who are already doing it. They don't have to have some formalized training to learn how to do it. They already do it.
And what is the likelihood that these patient engagement programs and so forth can make a tangible contribution and move that needle forward? What are the prospects that some of the technologies that we're seeing out there in the patient activation or patient engagement domain can actually bridge the gap?
So one of the technologies that's out there is the patient decision aid. And it's so funny because when I give talks about shared decision making and talk about patient decision aids, general audiences think an aid is a person. But a patient decision aid is a thing, and it's often a brochure plus a video that helps convey to the patient information about the procedure that they're facing, or the choices of procedures, what the trade-offs are involved in each of them, and how what they care about matters in the conversation with their clinician. And it's very clear that these technologies can have a significant impact on the decisions that patients make. There are more than 80 randomized controlled trials that look at patients who get usual care, which is just their doctor telling them about what the procedures are and what they ought to do, versus patients who have access to decision aids. And the two groups make very, very different decisions. So we know that there's one kind of technology that can make a difference. Another technology is how doctors think about their role. And that's not a technology, it's really an attitude, but there are going to be ways to help physicians think very, very differently about how they inform their patients, how they include their patients in those decisions.
What are some of those ways? What does it look like?
I think that we're going to be simply training physicians, for one thing. I think that there are going to be measurement tools. Gordon Moore talked about measurement tools. Judy Hibbard talked about measurement tools. And those measurement tools are going to be very important in kind of motivating clinicians and helping clinicians learn how to do it. Modeling the behavior is part of what will change the way physicians practice and nurses practice.
Okay, so back to the panel. What was your opening remarks, and what did you hear, or did you learn anything from the panelists?
I learned a huge amount from the panelists, but the sort of take-home message that I learned was that there are going to be many roads to Mecca, and to mix my metaphors, and getting to really engaging patients is going to take a lot of different kinds of tools. It's going to take having good decision aids. I want to see decision aids certified. There are going to be a lot of things out there that are calling themselves decision aids but are really marketing tools. So I want to see decision aids certified. I want to see training young clinicians to be able to engage patients be part of every single medical school in this country. We're not there yet. And in fact, one of the panelists, I think it might have been Chris Seigel from UCLA, said that he thought that patient engagement should be a fifth vital sign. That is your patient feeling like their worries, their desires, their goals have been discussed? Has that happened? And if it hasn't, you've got to go back and do it again. It's just like making sure their temperature is correct.
And what part does listening play in that exchange?
Listening is key. Listen to the patient. You talk to every great clinician, and they will tell you that listening to the patient is the sine qua non of being a good clinician. Right now, clinicians feel very rushed, especially primary care, and they tend to interrupt their patients in the middle of the patient sort of conveying what it is that they're concerned about. And clinicians need to be quiet and listen to their patients. And they're getting better at it, I think.
I believe the statistic I heard was the average time between patients speaking and being interrupted is 18 seconds?
Yes, it's an improvement from the 15 seconds of a few years ago. We need to get to more like 5 minutes of letting the patient talk.
And how much of that pressure is really driven by the payment model or the payment constraints?
I think part of it is driven by payment constraints and the fact that primary care physicians in particular need to keep that stream of patients running through. I think another piece of it, though, has to do with arrogance. And I know you're not supposed to say bad words about doctors, but I think in many cases it has to do with the sense that I know what the right answer is here. I'm the doctor, I'm the one who went to medical school, and therefore I'm the one who knows what the right answer is. And sometimes the patient knows what the right answer is, but they have to get to it. They have to be allowed to get to it.
And some say the solution to pollution is dilution, and perhaps with the newer physicians coming on, particularly an overexpressed, appropriately so, quadrant of women entering medicine. I believe it's over 50% now. There's a greater sense to having more of that patient engagement DNA, so to speak. Or would you agree with that?
I don't think that women have the corner on the market of listening. I think that I don't see that women are necessarily going to be better listeners as clinicians. Maybe they will.
That's surprising me. So we're at an ACO conference. How does all this play in terms of this ACO triple aim holy grail pursuit?
So I think that ACOs have been particularly interested in patient engagement because there is a perception out there that if you do share decision making, you reduce demand for expensive procedures like bypass surgery, like stents, like gallbladder surgery, knee replacement. And net, that may be so. But that's not the reason to do it. The real reason to engage patients is because it's the right thing to do, because it's better care, because it's ethical care. But ACOs will increasingly have other reasons to do it, and that will have to do with measuring the quality of the care that they're delivering. And so as we get better and better at measuring sort of what really matters to patients, what really matters to their outcomes, ACOs will have to find ways to engage patients at various levels for all kinds of procedures. Now, one of the things that we didn't talk about because it's poisonous in American society is end-of-life care. And I think that there is no other time in one's life than as we age and grow frail and elderly and approach death, when really making sure we know what patients care about is more important.
Great. I'm going to mention that one of the questions from the audience on the panel was the idea that people are throwing around definitions of patient engagement, and there are no standards necessarily. There's a framework, I believe, but there are no standards per se. And it was presented back to the panel, and I believe one of the answers was, I can't rise to that level of occasion to actually give that definition. Is that truly the state of the art?
Well, patient engagement at some point ought to be so baked into the DNA of medical practice that to pull it out would be impossible. I think it was Glenn Elwin who said he wasn't going to be able to give a definition of patient engagement, yet he has been steeped in this work for most of his career. It is difficult because it should be so pervasive in medicine. The idea that you talk to patients, you ask patients what they care about, you help them understand what it is that's at stake for them. You help them understand what the trade-offs are in the kinds of treatments that they're contemplating. That should be just absolutely part of the DNA of medicine.
Let me come back at you in one respect. If it's gender neutral and it's not totally driven by the or by the payment model, what is it?
It's the culture. It's the culture of the way we've trained physicians. I think it really goes back to the Flexner report. Flexner came along around the turn of the 20th century and basically found a complete hodgepodge of how young physicians were being trained and a lack of scientific rigor at most of these educational institutions. And so the Flexner revolution was really towards an increasingly scientific approach to medicine. We have run that course and lost something very, very important about medicine, which is the caring for the patient. To do as much as possible for the patient, as little as possible to the patient. So the culture of medicine has to change.
Rate the prospects 5 years out.
Oh, I think that it's going to be, I'm very bearish, as Gordon Moore is, about the prospects of really fundamental and positive change. We're going to go through a very terrible period, however, to get there. I don't know that we'll be there in 5 years. I hope we will be there in 15 or 20. I have a 17-year-old right now, and I hope by the time that he needs medical care, that the system is much better. Just by the time I'm old, that it will be affordable.
Just to clarify, bullish or bearish?
Oh, excuse me. Bullish.
You're bullish.
I'm bullish.
But pain points on the way.
But pain, serious pain on the way. Serious disruption. We are looking at a period when there's going to be disruption in labor, since in many communities, healthcare is the biggest employer, the biggest single employer. We're going to see huge disruption in labor. We're going to have to rethink who we train and how we train them. We are going to see serious disruption in the flow of money. I think we're going to see some catastrophic failures of hospitals. I think we could see a real impact on financial markets, which have lent the hospital industry a lot of money.
Well said. Thank you very much, Shannon. I'm an admirer of you, and I can't let this interview end without telling you you're wonderful in Escape Fire. And I'm wondering, did you get any blowback from some of the content of the movie?
I got a lot of positive feedback from Escape Fire, the movie. The young fellow who was the co-director, Matt Heineman, has been working tirelessly to try to get the movie out there and get people really thinking about the kind of revolutionary change that has to happen in our healthcare system. This is not just a little tinkering around the edges. This is deep and fundamental change that has to happen.
And I saw it. It was previewed at the CAPG annual meeting, and then CNN picked it up, so it got nice wide distribution.
It did. I suspect hundreds of thousands of people have seen the movie by now, and I hope that they're thinking hard about what kind of change has to occur.
Shannon, thanks for the gift of your time. Very grateful. Okay.